Butler, everybody. That is really our own Kaylee Butler from Youth Radio Project speaking to us from Bulgaria. And she'll be back, and she'll be back to tell us more about her travel adventures. And now we're going to go to Dr. Diana Sheets. Diana Sheets is an historian, a novelist, and a blogger. And she holds a PhD in European history from Columbia and has taught at Princeton and at the University of Illinois. And she joins us tonight to talk about the competing narratives of the presidential and vice presidential candidates as described in her literary and political blog, literarygulag.com. Diana Sheets, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mary.
Well, wonderful. Thanks so much for joining us again. Listeners, I actually did talk to her earlier tonight, and she's back. So thank you very much for coming back again.
My pleasure.
So your publicist describes what you are doing as using a mix of literary and political techniques to decode the narrative and provide the magic key, and I quote there, to understanding the competitors in this election. So can you just talk to us about what those techniques are that you employ and what the magic key is?
Okay. Well, I don't know if it's exactly a magic key, but what I wanted to figure out is you have a lot of bloggers out there who can give you all of the facts, but what I really wanted to understand was what was really underneath all of that driving the narratives that are going to emotionally affect voters to determine the outcome. And in considering that, I did a lot of reading, and what I concluded is I ended up looking at a book by George Lakoff called Moral Politics. And he was trying to examine why the Democrats have had such a difficulty getting in power, and so he's a linguist by training. And what he concluded is that that the political narratives of Republicans and Democrats are based on our foundational experiences in a family. And so the Republican narrative is the notion that the life is difficult and that the world is fundamentally dangerous. That's actually a quote by him. And so the type of language that are, the Republicans would use would be words like character, virtue, discipline, self-reliance, responsibility, authority, independence. And the liberals, on the other hand, have what I would call a feminine narrative. He calls it a nurturant parent or a nurturant mother narrative. And they regard government and, by extension, the Democratic Party as being a very supportive environment. And so children are at the heart of their story, and they're looking for love, empathy, nurturance, protect, and fairness. And that you can basically divide the two parties into those categories, and that all the politics that emanates from the parties stems from those core values.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask you a couple of terminology questions, okay?
Sure.
So now, I'm aware of this. There's a distinction, I think, between the term narrative and the term story. What is the distinction?
I haven't really considered that. You know, as a writer who writes fiction mm-hmm. and who's trained in politics, to me, narrative is a story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you wouldn't say there really is much of a distinction, right?
No, nope, not
it's just
at all.
Another word for the same thing.
Yep.
Okay, and then now I was reading an article about the McCain strategy narrative in the Times today, and there's a term that comes up all the time. It's called a meta-narrative. What would you say is a meta-narrative?
You know, all these terms are all literary. A meta-narrative is like meta-literature. It's this grand, overarching theme or principle that ties together the whole force of the story. That's what I'm assuming they mean by that.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I guess you would say McCain's meta-narrative is the notion of being a soldier and having been a prisoner of war for 5.5 years, and it's the notion that through that experience he realized the importance of nation and really the diminishment of self, that self is not that important, and what matters is coming together as a people and putting something bigger than yourselves in front of you. So mm-hmm. that would be his narrative. Whereas if I were to contrast that with Obama's meta-narrative, his dreams of my father is a story about a young man's search for selfhood and racial identity. And so you could make an argument that his narrative, whereas McCain's narrative is an external journey to overcome physical obstacles, and that people can verify its truth or falsehood, the Obama narrative is an internal journey. It's solipsistic. Most of the story is him thinking about himself and his journey. And so it's very hard to prove its authenticity. But emotionally, I think the Obama narrative is a story that young people can deeply identify with.
Well, now, so in talking about the Obama narrative, and then there was his biography too, or his autobiography. But are those the same things? And has his campaign, the narrative of his campaign, pretty much identified with his autobiography, or has it taken a separate track, would you say?
Well, what he's done, I mean, what he's been able to do is take the dreams for finding out who he is and becoming a young man, and by the end of that journey, he talks about the importance of realizing also, in his case, that there's something more than self, and the self is improving, you know, the lives of those who are disadvantaged, which is the classic Democratic narrative about social justice and fairness.
Mm-hmm.
So he's from that, you know, he ends up in his dreams of my father as a social organizer. And at that point, just like McCain, who realizes there's something bigger than self, for Obama, he realizes it's more than just a personal journey. It's the journey of a nation and a people and making sure that injustice is eliminated.
So would you say then, I mean, it kind of sounds to me like it is, but let me just check it out with you. Would you say that the McCain narrative does very much identify with the notion of, like, the world is a dangerous place and we have to be protected, and versus the Obama narrative being nurturative and so forth?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at McCain assumes that there are fundamental threats out there, and that you have to be prepared, and you have to be strong, and you have to be prepared to face adversity. And it assumes that the world is not a nice world, that terrible things happen, and you must be strong and must be prepared to defend yourself. The Obama narrative, it's from the school of play nice. It wants to assume that people are fair and just, and that we can all get along, and that we should be less aggressive, and that through goodwill we can achieve a better society. And certainly that's a narrative that everybody would like. We'd all love to believe that the world is a kind, wonderful place, and if only people were taught how to behave, they would behave. But I happen to think the McCain narrative is the more honest narrative.
Oh, okay. So, and let me ask you this. So most people don't seem to have thought that the Obama narrative has drifted too much. Well, on the other hand, there's a lot of discussion of McCain having, I think the word that they're using mostly is lurch, that he's lurched from kind of strategy or story to story. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think that at all. I think his narrative, his story, has been remarkably consistent. It's been about the discovery of that the nation is the most important thing, and he's used Teddy Roosevelt as a model. But what has changed in the McCain circumstances is that in order to try to combat Obama's advantage, they've had to change strategies.
Mm.
So, for instance, the selection of Sarah Palin as a vice presidential candidate was a tactical strategy to try to appeal to a younger audience because of Obama's, you know, tremendous appeal with a younger generation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, now let's just turn to then to the vice presidential candidates. So what are their narratives?
Well, again, you have two very different narratives. Now, keep in mind that Joe Biden was selected because the Democrats were very worried that Obama would be considered as not having enough experience and potentially weak in foreign affairs. So Joe Biden was regarded as a fairly conservative senator with a lot of experience. He's been in the Senate for 35 years, and he's been a fairly conservative on foreign policy issues. So on the surface, he looks a little bit more like the conservative narrative. He looks, he regards the world as, that you might see him as regarding the world as potentially dangerous. However, if you actually examine his positions on foreign affairs and foreign policy, I think you could make a very good case that it doesn't match with the Republican narrative. So, for instance, in 1991 in the Gulf War, when President H.W. Bush, the father to George, the current president, took us to war, he was initially against that, and then later under the Clinton administration, he changed his position, and then initially was for the second war, and is now against it. And he's been there was an interesting article in the National Review that was by Andrew McCarthy, who was basically saying that Obama is one of the strongest supporters of the UN, and many people believe that the UN is very feminized. It's all the disadvantaged nations, and we shouldn't be caving into those values.
An opposite to that? I mean, is NATO the opposite to the UN or something like that? Is there some group that's a masculine group?
NATO is sort of sitting there in the balance. It's hard to know. I mean, right now, Europe hasn't really decided how they're, I think they've been sitting there sort of on the fence. I think that's been one of the problems for the current administration. We really haven't had the support that we would like. I mean, Britain certainly was there for us, and but really, I think you have to realize that for the past, really since World War II, as a society, we've wanted to believe that war is over and there's never any cause worth fighting for. And so, to tie this into Sarah Palin, she's really interesting because.
Yeah.
You have a very attractive woman, but her narrative, her story, her position is a male narrative, but her persona is very feminine.
So that sounds like an ideal candidate then, or maybe not. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a wonderful, brilliant strategy on the part of the Republican Party, and I think there's real substance there. I don't think it's just a persona that she puts on. I think that is Sarah Palin, and the Republican Party has been trying to answer the question of where are we going to be for the future and how are we going to maintain our base of support. And Sarah Palin is really appealing to that future party because the argument has been made by some conservatives. A book called Grand New Party said that the party of the future can't be about the country club. It's got to be about those people who shop at Sam's Club, those ordinary Americans who have the values of independence and self-sufficiency, but they're ordinary Americans. And Sarah Palin really fits that model for the future of the party.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you about this country club business for a second. I mean, I have read some things that have indicated that the country club folks, or, I mean, I guess you could also call them the latte sipping, et cetera, et cetera. folks, I mean, those people are, or at least the country club people, are shifting over to the Democratic Party. So the Democratic Party might be looked at more as the party of elitism than the party of the have-nots. What about that?
Well, I certainly think from a financial standpoint, there is that shift. I mean, right now you've got voters, because of the economy, who are very worried and very disaffected, and the best chance, Drew Weston did a book called The Political Brain, and the best chance the Democrats always have is when the economy is doing very, very badly and then people are very worried about their future. Because what happens under those circumstances is that they long for a nurturant mother. Mm. They long for a safe environment that will protect them.
Mm-hmm.
And so under those circumstances, you're going to get some defectors from the Republican camp. So you have people who say, this war is too expensive, it's too costly, I don't see what the point is, I'm worried about the economy, I'm worried about my job. And that type of person, some of those people might be inclined to look at Obama as being able to produce a more protective society and a change in outlook.
Mm-hmm. I did hear recently that FDR, who of course was president in the Depression of the 1930s, felt very strongly from the very beginning that security was part of the important mission of the government and of him as a leader and of the government in general, that to allow people to feel secure was the whole role of government.
But keep in mind at that time there was about, I think, one out of four people was unemployed in America, and there were not the protective mechanisms in power. Imagine if our financial system had totally collapsed and there hadn't been any bailout, and then for years you basically had soft money and nobody had jobs. I mean, if in the 30s, if it hadn't been for the fact that most Americans lived on farms, then it would have been just unimaginable.
Right.
And I think under those circumstances, he was an incredibly astute president to realize what was needed for the nation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, talk just a little bit. You've talked a little bit about gender in politics. What about race? And the narrative, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, the narrative for race. Well, I think it's I think that Obama's a very interesting case because he's really trying to transcend notions of race and trying to be a unifier for the nation. And there's been a lot of debate by political pundits and commentators as to whether that's really possible and whether he can really do that. There was an article by Joshua Morawczyk that's in Commentary that's really basically challenging that whole notion that there is a unified America, one America, and that Obama really is best positioned to appeal to that group. As he points out, Obama was really voting solely in the Democratic camp 96% of the time, and does that really give him the credentials to be a unifier between the two parties? I mean, you can certainly make a very strong case that McCain has been much more of an individual who's been walking between the two camps trying to find a way to bridge the two perspectives. But Obama has, you know, he's wonderful at presenting himself. And you have a younger generation that really tries not to see things in terms of ethnic approaches. Mm-hmm. And you have many Americans saying, well, I'm very worried about the future. And I think, this election is about more than race.
Okay. Well, Diana Sheets, let me ask you this. You've been thinking about this from a particular point of view. What do you think is going to happen on November 4th?
Well, it's been so much fun. You can't really tell what's going to happen. The polls, of course, are saying that it's going to be an Obama victory, and it could be a very significant victory. But I've heard conflicting numbers. I've heard some, like Dick Morris was, and I haven't seen the recent figures, but they were speculating there would be some better figures for McCain early this week. But the figures I've heard are 11 or 12% edge for Obama versus, but I've also heard similar, Morris talking about 2 or 3% difference, and that's just a margin of error. So I would guess that it's looking like it's going to be an Obama victory, but I certainly wouldn't want to put a lot of money on guaranteeing what the outcome would be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you know what? How about if after November 4th we come back to you and check it out with you and get some more forecasting and so on, okay?
Well, I would love that.
All right. Diana Sheets, thank you so much for talking to us tonight. That's very interesting, and lots of luck with everything. And you can find out what Dr. Diana Sheets has to say about all this by going to her blog at literarygulag, that's GULAG.com.